morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. We have two cases to be submitted today on oral argument. Begin with Exelon Wind 1 LLC.
May it please the court.
Mr. Sullivan.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. James P. Sullivan for the PUC. I'll be joined at the podium today by counsel for interveners. Mr. Parrish and I will speak to jurisdiction, Mr. Moss will speak to the merits, and Mr. Parrish will return for rebuttal. This case belongs in a state court under Section 210G1 of the PURPA, not in a federal court under Section 210H2B. 210H does nothing more than enforce the PURPA's door-opening provision, and Exelon concedes, as it must, that PUC has already opened its doors and adjudicated the PURPA dispute between Exelon and Southwestern, the utility in this case. That means that we're talking about a jurisdictional provision that is an enforcement provision with nothing left to enforce. There's no work for the federal courts to do here and no authority with which to do it. To understand why the PURPA's jurisdictional scheme works this way, it's important to consider the statute in light of what Justice O'Connor has called the troubling federalism issues that the statute presents. If we look to the asserted basis for jurisdiction here, 210H2B, we see that it provides that a petitioner may bring an action in the appropriate United States District Court to require such state regulatory authority to comply with the requirements of 210F1. And so we turn our eyes up the page to look at 210F1, and this is where things get really interesting for 10th Amendment aficionados. 210F1 provides that each state regulatory authority shall, after notice and opportunity for public hearing, implement rules promulgated by the federal agency, FERC, under the PURPA. This is a really remarkable provision of federal law, and any modern student of constitutional law that would look at this would say, that looks like commandeering of the sort that the Supreme Court has held in Prince and in New York versus United States to be forbidden by the 10th Amendment. But even before the Supreme Court had issued those seminal decisions, it recognized that 210F is, in the words of FERC versus Mississippi, intrusive, troublesome, and disturbing. And the way the Supreme Court in Mississippi got around these substantial 10th Amendment problems was to squeeze 210F's implement command into such a small shape that it fit into the Testa versus Cat cubbyhole. So the implement command, in the words again of the Mississippi court, does nothing more than serve as a door opening provision. The state agency, quote, can satisfy 210's requirements simply by opening its doors to claimants and adjudicating their PURPA claims along the lines of Testa versus Cat.
So it's either unconstitutional or it's too narrow to give us jurisdiction.
Right. And I think that you raise a really important point, Judge Elrod. This court does not need to hold any provision of the PURPA unconstitutional to decide the jurisdictional issue in this case in the way that I've suggested that you should, because our argument is based on a constitutional avoidance canon, just like the Mississippi court's interpretation of 210F was. You should, when you give 210F1 the narrow understanding that is required by Supreme Court precedent, it has a similar narrowing effect on the jurisdictional grant, 210H2B, because, again, 210H2B provides for jurisdiction over an action to require a state agency to comply with 210F1's requirements. Well, there's no dispute in this case that the PUC has already complied with 210F's narrowed requirements, because we did open our door to adjudicate Exelon's dispute with Southwestern. You can see this from reading their complaint in this case. They are aggrieved by a particular order of the PUC, the May 1st, 2009 order, and they want declaratory and injunctive relief with respect to that particular order. So we're talking about the output of the adjudicative process that happened after PUC opened its doors and adjudicated the dispute here. So there's no Testa versus Cat problem here, and therefore there's no reason for us to be in federal court in the first place. I think Exelon got that right and understood that when they started their quest for judicial review in the state courts here. But they non-suited their state court action and went instead to a federal court that didn't have jurisdiction to entertain this suit. And returning to Judge Elrod's question, you don't have to hold that this jurisdictional provision violates the Tenth Amendment. What you should do instead is construe it narrowly so that you don't have to decide that question and do the grave work of a federal court holding that a federal statute is unconstitutional. Now,
construe it exactly how and then what result?
You should construe it to say that 210H2B gives the federal courts jurisdiction to enforce the door-opening provision in 210F, so that if a state agency is adjudicating state law disputes between utilities and qualifying facilities, but it's discriminating and not adjudicating analogous federal law disputes under the PURPA, then a federal court has jurisdiction to enter an injunction that says, state agency, you must open your doors and adjudicate this dispute under the PURPA. But at that point, the federal courts fall out of the equation, and judicial review proceeds, and sensibly so, in the state courts under Section 210G1 of the PURPA. And that really makes sense, because the PURPA here is setting up a kind of cooperative federalism regime, where the state agencies and the federal agencies are working together to carry into effect the goals of the Congress and the PURPA. And it makes sense that if the state agencies are going to be dragged into this process, they get home field advantage, as it were, in the state courts. That's a perfectly sensible place for judicial review of state agencies to happen.
Does it matter that Exelon took actions inconsistent with your theory and the plaintiff?
Does it matter that they took actions
by just non-suiting the state and asking for federal?
I don't think that it does, Your Honor. I don't think that the behavior of the parties can confer jurisdiction upon a federal court. And the fact that the FERC told them that they should do this doesn't change anything either. Of course, in Bowles against Russell, the Supreme Court held that even though the party there had missed the jurisdictional notice of appeal deadline, when an Article III judge told that party, you have this long to file the notice of appeal, even that bad advice did not excuse the firm and inflexible jurisdictional limits that were set by the Congress on the federal courts.
Do we have a situation here where they're challenging how the PUC has interpreted the FERC and that the PUC's misinterpreting the federal regulation?
Well, that's certainly their argument, but I think that that's an argument that the state courts are perfectly competent to decide. I think, Judge Prado, your question echoes some of the issues that have been raised by Exelon in their brief. They say that there might be preemption concerns at issue here, that if the PUC did something that was contrary to what the FERC or the Congress has required, then federal law is going to trump state law. The PUC does not contest the supremacy of valid federal laws here, but we would also point out that, as the members of the panel who have sat on state courts will recall, state judges are under an oath under the Constitution of the United States to recognize the supremacy of federal law, and they answer preemption questions like this as a matter of course. So the rule of decision in the state court might be informed by federal law, but that doesn't mean that we have to be in a federal court. Now, our friends from the federal government, the FERC, and they're, I guess, the empty chair here today, they have a different understanding of this jurisdictional scheme, but for the reasons that we've pointed out in our brief, you do not owe Chevron deference to the FERC's interpretation of the jurisdictional provision.
Why isn't FERC here to tell us how they interpret? Don't they sometimes come in and do that?
They certainly have the authority to do so, or they could have filed an amicus brief. Those are not my governmental clients.
It's
a little bit baffling because it's a self-aggrandizing interpretation of 210H2B that the FERC has offered, but they've not offered it even in a brief to you. They've given an informal, declaratory, non-binding statement that they and, by extension, the federal courts have more authority than we think the Tenth Amendment would allow.
And no precedent requires us to give any deference to the declaratory statement.
That's exactly right, Judge Elrod. And indeed, precedent for three different reasons points in the opposite direction. First of all, the canon of constitutional avoidance trumps Chevron deference, and we think that the FERC's interpretation of this jurisdictional provision, for the reasons that I've explained.
But with just an easier thing on deference, this is not the type of document.
Oh, that's exactly right, Judge Ellard. You're right.
Declaratory.
That's right.
A litigation position to which we're not, we don't have to give deference. We choose to if we find it persuasive.
That's right. Which
we're settled. We don't have to get into.
Yes, you, Judge Ellard. That's the Chevron step zero point. That if the federal agency has not been delegated the authority to speak with force of law by the Congress, then its interpretation of the statute is not binding on a federal court, and in that instance, it's the federal court's duty to say what the law is, in the words of Marbury.
The question itself is more problematic for you.
Well,
so I have to give our reference.
And that's certainly true, but that's a merits issue. And before you would get to that, you would first have to resolve the jurisdictional argument against me. I hope that you won't, and I hope that you'll decide it on the grounds that I've suggested. Mr. Parrish is going to talk a little bit more about the jurisdictional argument as it relates to the so-called Greensboro lumber dichotomy between implementation challenges going to federal courts and as-applied challenges going to state courts. And PUC stands shoulder to shoulder with our friends from the interveners here on that jurisdictional argument as well. This is an as-applied challenge, not an implementation challenge, because this is a dispute about a particular application to a particular party in a particular PUC order. Now, the district court disagreed with us on that, because, in its words, we, quote, impliedly found something with respect to wind power generally. That's at page 1279 of the Record on Appeal. As the PUC's attorney, I'm here to tell you, the PUC did not impliedly find any such thing. Indeed, if you look at what we explicitly said in our order here, we deleted a proposed finding of fact that went broader than necessary to adjudicate this particular dispute as to this particular wind generator. And Mr. Parrish will elaborate on this argument. But as I say, before you would get to the question of our deference of the FERC's interpretation of its own regulations, you would first have to interpret the jurisdictional scheme, and we submit that you can do it along the lines we've suggested. So because this is not an action to require a state agency to comply with the requirements of 210F1, because indeed we've already complied with them, this case does not belong in a federal court. And this court should vacate the judgment and remand with directions to dismiss for want of subject matter jurisdiction. Thank you for so much of your time today.
All right, thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Parrish.
Your Honors, may it please the court. Ashley Parrish on behalf of Occidental. I will address the jurisdictional issue, and what I would like to do in my time is three things. First, make a brief comment on Texas's jurisdictional argument. Second, explain to the court why under the traditional implementation versus as-applied test, this case belongs in state court. And third, respond to what I believe are their two main arguments. In addition, Judge Elrod, in that context, I'd like to talk a little bit about our deference and why that shouldn't apply here. Let me just say this about Texas's jurisdictional argument. We think this is a very serious constitutional argument. As we put forth in our briefs, though, we do urge the court to exercise some caution here for a couple of reasons. One is that it is a new argument that is somewhat inconsistent with the way that this scheme has developed over the last 30 years. We don't know of any court that's actually seriously grappled with the commandeering questions that they've raised. Second,
I don't want us to rule on the Tenth Amendment here.
Well, Your Honor, I think that you can avoid that by applying the implementation because it is such an easy case here. But the other thing the reason why I think it's a little difficult for this court, with all respect to opposing counsel, is I just don't think they have responded to Texas's argument on this at all, in the sense that the vague references to the spending clause is somewhat responsive, but it's unelaborated, and the references to preemption is non-responsive at all. So for that reason, we think that the court can actually apply a narrowing construction that would avoid that issue altogether, which is just to accept the parties coming to the case looking at this through an implementation for as-applied challenge. All parties agree that if this is an as-applied challenge, then it belongs in state court. And
can an individual suit ever be an implementation action under your proposed way of handling the case, or have we just been carved out a whole category of cases that are never implementation challenges?
Well, Your Honor, for example, I think that if Exelon in this case had challenged Rule 25.242, which is the rule that Texas, the Commission itself, adopted as the implementing rule, if they had challenged that rule, and if the relief they had sought was specifically targeted striking down the rule as a failure to implement, then I think, you know, that could very well go forward. The problem here, though, and this takes me to my second point as to why this is clearly as applied, if you take a look at the way this case has been framed both by Exelon and by the Commission, this is not an implementation challenge. First, they do not challenge the rule itself, which was implemented 30 years ago. They don't even attempt to show that that rule in all of its applications, i.e. on its face, is invalid. They also do not dispute that the Commission, when it elected to decide how it would implement the purpose scheme, that it made clear that it would do that by regulation, not on a case-by-case basis. They cannot get around the fact that their complaint itself seeks very specific Exelon-specific relief, including relief targeted for telling the PUC to reopen its docket, telling the PUC what it must do. And also, they cannot get around the fact that the Commission itself was very clear in its orders that it was not deciding things for everybody. It was not setting forth a categorical rule, but instead what it was doing was deciding things on a case-by-case basis, one time only. The next case may present a different circumstance.
I assume, though, that you wouldn't your client wouldn't object to the result if we were to say that there is federal court jurisdiction and that the district court was wrong to enjoin the firm power rule.
You mean, Your Honor, reach the merits of the case?
Reach the merits.
Your Honor, we obviously would not object. I think what's easy about this case, with all respect, is that whether you look at this from a jurisdictional matter or as a merits matter, it's pretty clear that the district court unfortunately got this wrong. And that we're right that this case either belongs in state court or on the merits. It's clear that this is not the type of thing that runs around and violates FERC's regulations. And Your Honor, maybe if I could just jump, because I'm running out of time, to this point about our deference. I think, Judge Elrod, you have exactly encapsulated the way to look at the issues. But the one thing I'd maybe quibble with is that you only get our deference when you're interpreting your own regulations, right? But if you take a look at the Christopher case decided by the Supreme Court just a couple of terms ago, the Supreme Court is very concerned about situations where agencies, through these types of informal type guidance documents in Christopher and Amicus brief, changes a longstanding established practice that parties have relied on, which is what seems to be what FERC is doing here. And in that case, in Christopher, no hour deference because they were unsettling settled expectations. That's particularly true in the PURPA context because in 210A, more so than in any other administrative law context, FERC has been directed that if you want to restrict the state's authority to implement these things, you must go through notice and comment rulemaking with involvement by the states, which means that you shouldn't be able to engage in these informal ways of changing your regulations. You have to do it through notice and comment rulemaking. They did not do that here. So for the reasons that Mr. Sullivan alluded to, but more specifically on the grounds of implementation versus as applied, I think that you can decide this. Your Honor, if you'd like to reach the merits, you can also rule in our favor. And on that, my colleague will address the merits issues.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Parrish. I believe we've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Moss.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Ron Moss. I represent Intervenor Southwestern Public Service Company, the utility that is at issue in this case. We agree with the Public Utility Commission and Occidental on the jurisdictional arguments, and we don't believe that the Court needs to reach the merits of this decision. But if you do reach the merits of this decision, we believe you should conclude that the Texas PUC acted within its discretion when it found that QFs must provide firm power in order to form legally enforceable obligations, which I'll refer to as LEOs. As a threshold matter, there can be no doubt that the PUC has a significant amount of discretion with respect to how it implements the FERC rules under PURPA. When FERC implemented its rules in 1980, it said that its rules afford the state regulatory authorities great latitude in determining the manner of implementation of the FERC rules. And as this court held in the Power Resource case 9 or 8 years ago, defining the parameters for creating an LEO is left to the states and their regulatory agencies. Now, the district court in this case concluded that the PUC abused its discretion by denying LEOs to QFs that cannot provide firm power. And the rationale that the district court relied on was the language in the FERC rules that says each QF has a right to provide power on an as-available basis or pursuant to an LEO. According to the district court, the word each means that every QF has the right to form an LEO. There are three serious problems with that interpretation. First, it cannot be reconciled with this court's decision in Power Resource. Second, it ignores the role of the Texas PUC in filling the gaps left by FERC. And number three, it produces a result that is inconsistent with the congressional intent underlying PURPA. So let me start with the first one, which is that the district court's reasoning cannot be reconciled with this court's decision in Power Resource. In Power Resource, this court held that the PUC did not violate the QF's right to form LEOs by requiring that the QF be able to provide power within 90 days of when the LEO is created. So under the holding of Power Resource, as we understand it, a QF has a right to form an LEO if, but only if, it complies with the state law requirements set forth for creating LEOs. And one of the requirements imposed by the Texas PUC is that the QF be able to provide firm power in order to create an LEO. And that firm power requirement is no different from the 90-day requirement that this court upheld in Power Resource. Now, the court below tried to distinguish Power Resource by claiming it only involved a timing and sequencing issue, whereas it said the firm power rule prevents an entire category from forming QFs from forming LEOs. I would submit that the district court misread your Power Resource decision. In that case, the QF argued that it needed an LEO to get the financing necessary to build its generating facility, and if it didn't get that financing, it couldn't build its generating facility. In effect, the 90-day rule foreclosed the possibility that that QF and many others like it would never be able to create LEOs. In effect, and as the plaintiff in that case said, the 90-day rule eviscerates the LEO option for unbuilt QFs. This court nevertheless upheld the PUC rule based on its holding that FERC regulations grant the state's discretion in setting specific parameters for LEOs. For reasons that aren't clear, the court below seemed to believe that the QF and Power Resource could get around the 90-day rule just by getting its financing before it got the LEO. But that's simply not true. It could never get financing if it didn't have an LEO. The 90-day rule essentially denied that QF and many other QFs like it the right to form LEOs, just as the firm powered rule does. Therefore, the district court erred by the district court's ruling cannot be squared with this court's decision in Power Resource. The second problem with the district court's plain language argument is that it assumes that the FERC gave some meaning to the term legally enforceable obligation that the PUC disregarded. That's not true either. In its PURPA rules, FERC defined a number of terms, but it did not define what it meant by legally enforceable obligation. It was up to the Texas PUC to give content to that term, and the Texas PUC did give content to that term by adopting a rule that said firm power is necessary in order to form an LEO. And as we point out in our brief, at least six other states adopted that same interpretation.
I mean, the whole scheme doesn't make sense otherwise, does it?
It does not.
You're a fixed price if you weren't providing a steady, reliable supply?
It does not, Your Honor. That's exactly right, because there is no real obligation on the part of a non-firm QF. They can only provide energy when the wind blows, and they don't know when the wind's going to blow. And when the wind blows, they may or may not have their turbines in service. The most they can promise is that they will deliver some amount of whatever energy they have whenever the wind blows and when their turbines are in service. The PUC acted within its discretion by saying, we don't believe that rises to the level of a legally enforceable obligation. And as this court said, if FERC had wanted to put more limitations, more parameters around what an LEO means, it could have done so, but it did not. And therefore, the Texas PUC had the power, had the discretion to give content to that term.
In doing what you're doing, are you in effect limiting the definition of what is a QF? It seems to me that FERC says what is a QF, and by you saying certain things are not there, are you in effect redefining what FERC meant for a QF to be?
Not at all, Your Honor. In fact, Exelon is still a QF. We are still purchasing all of their power from them. We've been purchasing all of their power from them since day one. If they were not a QF, we would not have the obligation to purchase their power.
Doesn't the law, though, guarantee them of having the option, and now you're coming and restricting that option, so aren't you, in effect, redefining what a QF is?
I would submit that we are not, Your Honor. As I said, we are buying their power. The LEO is about a pricing option, and that's really what this case is about, is pricing, what price they get, which takes us back to Mr. Parrish's point, which is that this is really an as-applied challenge, because we're talking about what price they are entitled to. And I want to take that to my third point, which is that if you interpret it the way that the district court did, you are undermining the congressional intent underlying PURPA. Now, there's no question that Congress wanted to encourage renewable generation, but it did not want to do so at the expense of ratepayers. In fact, Section 210B said ratepayers have to be held indifferent, meaning they can't be required to pay any more than what they would pay for some other type of generator. The district court's interpretation would nullify that intent, as the facts of this case show. At the time that we received these letters from Exelon, we could buy power for about 2.5 to 3 cents a kilowatt hour under long-term contracts. Exelon was demanding 6, 7, 8 cents per kilowatt hour for its power. Now, our ratepayers surely would not be indifferent if they had to pay 2 or 3 times the amount that we could buy long-term purchase power for at that time. My time is up. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, thank you for your time.
Mr. Anson.
Thank you, Your Honors. Tom Anson for the Exelon Wind Companies. What we have here is a case in which the state agency is thwarting the purpose of the federal statute, PURPA, and the FERC regulations that implement it. That purpose is to encourage investment of capital in alternative generation. It's not just renewable, it's biomass, geothermal. And what Congress recognized and what FERC recognized, and in fact, I've handed out the key excerpts from Order 69 that adopted the FERC's regulation, is that what you need in order to facilitate investment in new power plants is price certainty. Mr. Moss says this case is about the prices received. What this
so
case is...
You're going to have price certainty, but with absolutely no supply certainty. Is that right?
If there is no supply certainty, that goes into the level of the price. If it's more stable on the supply side, you get a higher price. If it's less stable, you get a lower price. And in Order 69, FERC made it clear that you can have a different kind of price depending on the level of the firmness, but that's on the second page of the handout where it's talking about the factors that go into the pricing.
Doesn't that adversely affect ratepayers?
No, it does not, Your Honor, because what FERC recognized on the first page when it talked about the ability to create a legally enforceable obligation is to have the ability to have price certainty based on an estimate of the avoided cost, which can vary over time, but nobody knows where that's going to end up at the end. In fact, in the hearing in this case, the forecast price, which was, by the way, SPS's own 10-year forecast price. We didn't demand anything other than what SPS calculated itself. At the time of the hearing, the time of delivery price was higher than the forecast price, and the aggregate revenues under that forecast price were also below what the aggregate revenues would be under the time of delivery price. That can flip back and forth over the term of the obligation, and no one can predict what that's going to be. And FERC in 1981 said that's okay as long as you have an estimate that is in the legally enforceable obligation that provides the price certainty to make an investment. The qualifying facility is taking the risk that they may be leaving money on the table, but it does allow them to make an investment decision because they know what the price certainty is. They can therefore make an evaluation of what the revenue stream is going to look like.
Are you going to address the jurisdictional question first?
I would be glad to. The Attorney General says that the 10th Amendment prevents this court from doing anything but requiring the PUC to open the door, and then that's all the PUC has to do. But that's not true. What FERC versus Mississippi said is you must also, and the Prince case that followed says you must apply the federal law. You must give effect to the federal law. And in fact, Judge Prado, in the Coug case, when you were a district judge, you recognized the same thing. You must give effect and apply the federal law. As FERC versus Mississippi says, it is the prevailing law. In that Coug case, you recognize there are differences when the federal government is talking to executive officers and when it's talking to legislative officers, but when it comes to an adjudicative tribunal, like a state commission, that it must give effect to and not rewrite the federal law.
But then you no longer have an exercise in cooperative federalism. You have a cram down from the federal government telling the state what it must do with its own power system.
Well, again, in the case of an adjudication, there is this exception that is recognized in FERC and in Prince. Plus, in this case, there is something more than just the 10th Amendment involved. The Texas legislature in 1981 also told the Public Utility Commission to implement FERC's regulations. Therefore, there really is no 10th Amendment issue here because the PUC was already under marching orders from the Texas legislature to do the same thing. And if the Texas legislature says to do it, then there is no 10th Amendment concern. As far as the implementation versus as applied aspect of jurisdiction, in the case of Occidental Chemical coming out of Louisiana, that was a challenge to a Louisiana Public Service Commission order. Not to its regulation, to an order, just like we have an order here. And there was no state court appeal of that order. And the issue was raised, is this an as-applied case or an implementation case? And the judge in that case said it is an implementation case because what the order said was it announced a new rule, in this case a methodology for calculating avoided costs, that applies to a broad scope of entities. And that's how you can tell what's an implementation case versus an as-applied case. In here, what we have is the PUC has not followed the plain language of FERC's regulations, which says each qualifying facility has the option to sell pursuant to a legally enforceable obligation and thereby lock in price certainty. Instead, it says some, but not all, qualifying facilities have the ability to do that. And when it said some, what it meant was wind alone. And it says so in the order. It then goes on and speculates that you could add something more and maybe, just maybe, have something that could take itself out of that wind alone category and move into some other category. That's like saying, well, you could instead decide of being a wind power, you could decide you're also going to be a natural gas fired cogenerator and move into that class of qualifying facility.
Are they asking for a new rule with to apply to a broad scope of entities, or are they asking, was the relief sought an as-applied challenge? I mean, the fact that you could answer the question with a broad rule doesn't tell you whether or not the question asked is a broad question or not, and that's the inquiry at issue.
Well, Your Honor, there is an overlap between what the effect of an as-applied a failure to implement FERC's rules is and an as-applied problem, because obviously if the entity who is the plaintiff is in this category amongst all the other broad scope of entities, the failure to implement does affect that plaintiff, gives it standing. But there are others out there as well. In fact, in this case, we have six qualifying facilities, not just one. There are six other Exelon Wind qualifying facilities that are in the exact same position, but they're not parties to this case because they were not in existence at the time that the original PUC complaint was brought. And there has been no suggestion by anybody on the other side that the Exelon Wind QFs are the only wind farms in the world that are wind alone.
But we have to look at what is the challenge brought.
And what we did challenge was FERC's failure to comply with the plain language of FERC's regulation. They do point to some relief that they characterize as applied relief. We had, you know, like a half a dozen or a dozen different kinds of claims for relief. And what we told Judge Sparks was, if you think any of those are as applied relief, don't grant them. Just grant the implementation claims. And that's what he did. He granted an injunction telling the PUC that it must no longer fail to implement PURPA, and did not grant any of the others that the other side characterizes as applied. So just because we threw something in that they characterized as applied doesn't mean it is, but in any event, it wasn't granted. One of the other aspects that you need to keep in mind is that the Order 69 language about the ability to have a price at the time the legally enforceable obligation is created applies to all qualifying facilities, such that the concerns that have been expressed about trying to take advantage of some sort of timing apply to all qualifying facilities. This has been the law since 1981. All QFs have the ability to create a legally enforceable obligation. Plus, those forecasts are long-term forecasts. The one we used here was SPS's own 10-year forecast. So some short-term blip in pricing doesn't have a ratchet effect where a qualifying facility, whatever type it may be, can just go in, lock in at that price, and be good for 10 years. There's a long-term forecast that's done by SPS, and whatever blips are going on in the market, that's why people want forecasts. That's why in making the investment decision you want price certainty, so you can sleep at night and not worry about the variability or volatility of the prices that you're going to receive. What Congress wanted to do was incentivize investment, and to do so you have to give capital a reason to be put to work. That requires some confidence that you're going to earn your capital back with a return. And price certainty is the key, and that's what this first page that I handed to you on Order 69 talks about. It says that what is a legally enforceable obligation is either a contract that the qualifying facility signs with the utility, or it is where the qualifying facility commits to deliver to the utility at a future date the energy and capacity that it has.
Could I ask you a factual question about Exelon?
Yes, ma'am.
Occidental seems to argue that Exelon could have provided firm power if it chose to build a storage facility but decided to provide only non-firm power. But given that wind is notoriously unpredictable, hard to store, is there anything in the record to indicate that Exelon is capable of or could be capable of providing firm power?
Your Honor, these plants were built in the mid-2000s. The kinds of storage techniques that Occidental talks about were not even in existence at that time, so they were not built with that in mind. And I suppose plants could be retrofitted to take them out of that category into another, but what the PUC has done is says for the category that is wind only, not wind plus something else, we are, in essence, excluding you from being able to create a legally enforceable obligation. So there's nothing in the record about what our wind projects could or could not do. They were built as wind alone.
They're speculating on what you could do. The record doesn't tell, and you to the extent I asked you to speculate, but you would say it would be very difficult, but that shouldn't be relevant to our analysis.
All I can do is speculate as well, Your Honor. The other things that Order 69 makes clear is that when the qualifying facility commits to deliver the energy and capacity to the utility, that is what then imposes upon the utility the obligation under PURPA to purchase. That is otherwise known as a non-contractual legally enforceable obligation, which this court in the Power Resource Group case recognized you can have. And the way you get there in Texas, the when and how, or the procedural steps, are to use what's called the 90-day rule, provide notice 90 days in advance of when you're going to deliver energy and then deliver the energy within those 90 days. Exelon Wind went through those steps. So regardless of what the arguments may have been made by the plaintiff in the Power Resource Group case about the 90-day rule, Exelon Wind proved that this court was right and that somebody can comply with the 90-day rule, can follow the dance steps that are necessary to create a legally enforceable obligation. What the PUC has done is say, well, you may know how to do the dance steps, but you are not invited to the dance just because you are solely fueled by an intermittent resource. And in response to the question you asked, Judge Smith, about the steady flow, it's the second page of Order 69 where they talk about the factors that go into the pricing, and that's where the firmness of the supply comes in. So, for example, a natural gas plant or coal plant that runs 24/7 will have a very high capacity factor and should get paid more for the higher value that that provides. Wind, on the other hand, has a much lower capacity factor. In fact, it's in the record that in SPS's own rate cases, it attributes a 10% capacity factor or capacity value to wind. So that's where the differential comes in, is in the pricing, not in the ability to create a legally enforceable obligation. The first page out of Order 69 is all about creating legally enforceable obligations. It does not indicate that there is any limit on the ability to do so based on your fuel type. The second page is about the factors. It's the very next page out of the Federal Register. But then it's talking about a different part of its own regulations. And that's where this legislative history is that the other side references, talking about firmness. All that firmness stuff is in the context of the discussion of how much the price should be, not whether you can create a legally enforceable obligation. And this is what protects ratepayers, is that the pricing is adjusted based on what it is you are supplying. But the ability to say, okay, I'll take the forecast price now so I have price certainty and invest, is a different question than what kind of price I can get for what I'm delivering. If you have different products, you get different prices for the products, but all qualifying facilities have the right to create a legally enforceable obligation so that they can have price certainty as to whatever it is that they are going to sell as a product. And if they sell a more valuable product, they can lock in a price for a more valuable product. And if it's less valuable, they can lock in a lower price for a less valuable one.
What weight or any, or what effect, of, if any at all, does the FERC's letter or declaration saying that the Texas firm power rule violated FERC regulations, does that carry any weight?
Yes, Your Honor, it should. First of all, FERC is the top expert on its own regulations. Second of all, the cases that talk about no legal moment when it comes to a declaratory order like this, the full language of those decisions is it's of no legal moment except for the deference that it commands as persuasive precedent or something to that effect. So if you think it's persuasive, you can give it that kind of deference.
Or we cannot give it any deference whatsoever, is under the case law, correct?
Well, as Judge Sparks said, he thinks that under the plain language of the regulation, the PUC got it wrong. Then he went on and said, but you know, to the extent that I need to give deference to FERC, I agree with FERC because they are the top expert on their own regulations, and they too think that the PUC got it wrong on the plain language, on the literal text of the regulation.
I'm asking you an agency law question. We don't have to give any deference to the declaration if we don't choose to. Is that correct?
Yes, you do not have to give any deference except to the extent that it is persuasive to you.
If we believe it is persuasive after reading it, and we think it persuasively animates the subject matter.
Well, there is, just not to be putting too fine a point on it, there is, as part of that same case language, it does say it's of no legal moment unless and until it is adopted by a district court. And Judge Sparks has basically adopted what FERC said in the declaratory order. So to that extent, it may be. But at the end of the day, I will agree that you do get, in essence, a de novo look at the FERC regulation. And I think what FERC has done as the expert should be very informative to your analysis. And I think deference would be due, just like you would give deference to any other persuasive authority out of some other circuit on a similar issue, but it's not binding on you, if that's your question, Judge Elrod.
Is there, this was a regulation that they wrote up, is that different from a statute, or what weight we should give between an agency interpreting a statute or an agency interpreting its regulation? Is there some difference there, or how does that affect this case?
For purposes of this case, I don't think there's a difference. Gave FERC direction. It implemented that direction in Order 69 by adopting these regulations. Those regulations were tested at least twice in the United States Supreme Court, once in FERC versus Mississippi on the 10th Amendment ground, and then on the avoided cost standards that are in here. That went up in the American Paper Institute case. And then FERC has had to implement this over a period of years where it gets asked on occasion to enforce against a state agency for failure to implement. And many of those times it will simply take no action, which is an exhaustion thing that allows people to go into court, but sometimes it does issue a declaratory order, as it did here. And in those other cases, when it issued a declaratory order saying that the state agency got it wrong vis-a-vis its rules, the state agencies went ahead and, without any further prompting, did it the way FERC said they should be doing it. This is, in fact, the first time that a state agency has refused to follow what FERC told them its regulation meant, which is why we've gotten to the point where we now have the first federal court ruling invalidating a state decision for failure to implement because the PUC refused to listen to what FERC had to say.
But there are a number of other states using this exact same scheme, and have those, just no one's brought challenges to them yet?
Well, they have on their books language where they've used the same kind of shorthand reference that the PUC used of firm versus non-firm. But the Texas case is the first time that anybody's actually explicated what that means and also did it in the context of a QF using an intermittent fuel source as its sole fuel. And so those other states don't have the same thing going on other than some language on their books that has not been interpreted by them.
The language is the same, and practically that it's going on the same way, and so it's just no one's raised it yet.
No one has raised it yet, and one thing you may want to know as a historical matter, a lot of these states, they have much more involved implementation schemes where qualifying facilities have a form of contract they can enter into with the utility, and there can be some proceedings around that. Texas used to do that. They got away from it. All we have is the 90-day rule, which is essentially self-implementing. Do these dance steps, and you have a legally enforceable obligation. Other states make you go through a lot more process, and so these issues just don't come up in those other states because they have a much more heavy-handed approach to making the utility and the qualifying facility get together and sign a contract. So it, as a practical matter, it just has not come up. And again, it's just language on the books that is has not really taken off like it has here, where you've had a real rubber meets the road decision about what does this mean, and in this context of intermittent only type fuel source.
Do you know why FERC's not here?
FERC typically does not appear in cases. Well, this is a first time, actually. But what they do is when they want to let people know their views, they do it in the declaratory order. So FERC is here in the virtual sense of its declaratory order.
Okay. What about D1? Is it superfluous under the FERC's reading and your reading?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Say that again.
D1, is it superfluous?
D1 of what?
You know what I'm talking about.
Referring to the third column of the first page of your handout.
Oh.
Considerable discussion of D1 as opposed to D2. It's a good question. It was going to be my next question.
Yes. What that is discussing is what as available means. And it says it means it is without obligation. The language of the regulation says that each qualifying facility has the option to sell either pursuant to a legally enforceable obligation, or it may sell as available as the seller determines.
Which is exactly what's happening here, isn't it? As a practical matter, you're selling as available.
No, Your Honor, because we have committed to sell all of our energy and capacity to the utility. We are not retaining any discretion as to whether or not we're going to sell it to the utility. We made, as you see in the middle column there, a commitment instead of signing a contract. As available, in as FERC says here, is what that means is without obligation. So that the...
What do you mean? It doesn't mean as available?
As available in the context of this regulation means as the seller determines it does or doesn't want to sell, as it thinks it wants to make it available. It's not the power plant's availability, which is not as strong when it's an intermittent resource, such as wind or solar, and the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining. It's in the head of the QF. If the QF says, I'll sell it to you tomorrow, but I'm not going to sell it to you the next day, that's as available, as the seller determines, as a matter of the seller's discretion. This is somebody thinking about it and deciding, making decisions about what they want to do, as opposed to plant operating characteristics.
Well,
and that's where the
duplicative then of D2.
Well, think of a decision tree. What the qualifying facility has is the option to sell pursuant to a legally enforceable obligation, at which point it then can choose either forecast pricing or time of delivery pricing. And it also can choose to sell just energy or can sell energy and capacity. If it decides it's going to sell on an as available basis, it can only get the time of delivery price. And it can only sell energy.
So
does that help?
What does D1 add if we modify it the way you ask us to modify? What does D1 give you that D2 doesn't already give you if we modify D1 and interpret it the way you're interpreting it?
Well, I'm not asking you to modify anything.
I didn't mean to load the question. What does D1 provide under the interpretation that you're expounding on that's not already provided by D2?
I think what Judge Elrod is asking, and correct me if I'm good question the way she phrased it. I think what she's asking is, aren't you just reading D1 completely out of the regulation because everything is provided for in D2?
No, Your Honor.
Yes, what is in D1 that's not already in your D2? Just give us one thing that's in D1 that's not already in D2.
I'm sorry, I don't have the regulation in front of me. I have Order 69, if you'll give me a moment to grab that. D1 says that the qualifying facility shall have the option either in one to provide energy as the qualifying facility determines to be available, and then says in which case it's time of delivery, pricing for energy. And D2 is the other option, which is or the qualifying facility can sell pursuant to a legally enforceable obligation.
Right, but it's, okay, so what's different? If you say as available means as available pursuant to your contract, and as you just were telling us, how is that not exactly what D2 already provides?
Well, in the context of a contract, if there's a contract, then you have a legally enforceable obligation. And so under PURPA, the utility has to buy even if there's no contract. And so the utility can be forced to buy on an as-available basis or sign a contract, or if it refuses to sign a contract, be put into a non-contractual legally enforceable obligation by the qualifying facility making the commitment. So the difference between D1 and D2 is D1 is seller, you can sell to the utility whether they want it or not, but unless you, the qualifying facility, make a commitment to sell to the utility, including by contract or in some other non-contractual manner, then all you get to do is just flow the energy to them and get the time of delivery price. But that's up to the qualifying facility to decide whether or not it wants to do it that way.
The reason, obviously, that the question is significant is that we have a lot of case law that says we don't interpret a statute or a regulation in such a way that makes a particular section or subsection superfluous. So,
correct, and it
we have to determine whether D1 actually confers meaning in addition to D2, or whether you're in effect reading it out.
I'm not reading it out, and I don't think FERC has read it out. Again, think of a decision tree where it says the qualifying facility has the option, and then it has the one option, which is as available, and that comes with energy-only sales at time of delivery prices, or it has another option, which is to sell pursuant to a legally enforceable obligation. If it goes down the D2 path, it gets some additional options. It can either do time of delivery pricing or forecast pricing, and it can also either sell energy only or sell energy and capacity. And then you get into the pricing of that, and that's the other part of the, that's subpart E, which is talked about on the second page of the Order 69 handout, the factors that go into the pricing. And I see I'm out of time, Your Honors. I'd be glad to answer any further questions, but I appreciate your allowing me to be here and ask that you affirm the order, the judgment of Judge Sparks below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anson. Mr. Parrish, let's take time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to do three things. Start, Judge Elrod, with a question that you asked, which I think frames it nicely. Mention a few things on jurisdiction, then finish with a point on the merits. Judge Elrod, you had asked specifically about this argument that the order effectively prohibits all QFs, and then what the evidence was in the record. Well, remember, the State Commission made specific findings there, and it just didn't have to do with modern technology, but also the fact that some wind farms are on the coast where it's more reliable. They could have built it on the coast rather than where they did it. The technology that they could invest in today, and also the ability to combine a wind facility with something like solar power or some other facility. My point is that the PUC gets discretion in determining those facts. To the extent that the PUC does not get that type of discretion, then at the minimum, on a summary judgment, those disputed issues of fact should be not resolved in the moving party's favor. And yet the judge was unwilling to allow us to have discovery. So I don't think you can need to get to the discovery point, because I think you just defer to the PUC's factual findings. But if you do, then we should win, because you can't resolve disputed questions of fact on summary judgment. That takes me to the question about the implementation versus as-applied challenge, which, again, it makes a difference as to whether you are bringing a facial challenge or as an as-applied, because it's a different burden. Opposing counsel mentioned the Louisiana case, which I know well, but in that case specifically, what the parties were doing was, first of all, arguing that what the PUC had done applied to everybody, in all contexts to everybody, and had also pled their case in that way. This is not what's happening here. With respect, Your Honors, on the 10th Amendment issue, opposing counsel just does not understand the commandeering argument. This is not a question about supremacy. The Texas legislature did pass legislation, that is true, but it did under the force of federal law at the time. With respect, again, as I said before, I don't think you need to decide the case on that grounds. We'd urge you to do it on the other grounds. And part of the reason is that I just don't think his arguments are grappling with what the commandeering argument is actually about. On the merits itself, first, I think it's significant that opposing counsel has essentially conceded that there is no Chevron deference here. That argument is now gone. That is the right concession to have made because it doesn't apply. But what is key here is to then take a look. He talks about the purposes of the statute in a general sense. Look at the Rodriguez case from the Supreme Court. You never look at just one purpose. You look at the statute and what the text tells you. So let's take a look at the statute and take a look at the regulation itself. Can he point to anything in either of those documents that defines what a legally enforceable obligation is? The answer is clearly no, he cannot. And the reason is because under power resource and because of principles of federalism, those types of things are left up for the states to decide. Your Honors, in answer to your questions, he is doing one of two things. He is either reading D1 out of the statute altogether, but I don't actually think that's what he's doing. What he really wants to do is to read D2 as saying everything is up for grabs, that a QF can come and dictate the terms of whatever it wants. Here, we'll decide that we want a 20-year term, an obligation for 20 years. We'll decide that we want the price to be three times what it otherwise would be. We're not going to tell you when we'll provide power. And this, you know, just to underscore my understanding is that this, we are talking about millions and tens of millions of dollars for the ratepayers based on the idea of whether or not you can lock in at these historically high rates in 2005, 2006. It is entirely reasonable for the state PUC to say, no, that is not appropriate. That's the discretion that they have. And to the extent that anyone disagrees with it, the state courts are very competent at deciding that. Let me also point out that there was some discussion about what that rate was. My colleague mentioned the fact that it's three times. It was, you know, instead of the 2 to 3 cents at the time, it was 8 cents. Opposing counsel made some comments about relying on the old schedules that the utility put together. Those were schedules for firm power, precisely recognizing the economic fact that if somebody is willing to provide a reliable source of energy, that gets paid for at a higher rate than if you just come at whenever you want on whatever terms you'd like.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is under submission.